Welcome to the deep dive. Ever wonder about that moment in law when the rules for corporate punishment really changed? Especially if you're, wrestling with torts, there's a case you absolutely need in your arsenal. Owens, Illinois v. Zenobia. That's a 1992 decision out of the Maryland Court of Appeals, and, well, it's a game changer.
That's right. Forget those lengthy case readings for a moment. Think of this as your express lane to understanding a pivotal shift in how courts handle punitive damages, specifically in product liability scenarios and the crucial concept of a company's ongoing duty related to its products.
Exactly. So our deep dive today is laser focused on making Zenobia crystal clear for you. We'll dissect the facts, the central legal battle, what the court actually decided and why, and most importantly, the lasting impact. We're pulling insights from detailed and standard case briefs, even a perplexity analysis, to give you a full 360-degree view. Okay, so let's get right to it. Where did this legal showdown even begin?
Right. The story starts with the unfortunate situations faced by William Zenobia and another individual, Louis L. Dickerson. They both filed lawsuits against Owens, Illinois, alleging significant injuries caused by their exposure to asbestos-containing products manufactured by the company.
And the legal argument here was built on something called strict liability, right? Under Section 402A of the Restatement, second, of torts. For anyone unfamiliar, that section basically says a manufacturer can be held liable if their product is defective and unreasonably dangerous, and importantly, if they knew about that danger.
Precisely. The core of their lawsuits was the assertion that Owens, Illinois was aware of the serious health risks associated with asbestos, but, continued to produce and sell these products anyway. Initially, the jury sided with Zenobia and Dickerson, awarding them substantial compensatory damages, $1.2 million and $1.3 million, respectively, to cover their actual losses.
And then came the part we're really drilling down on, the punitive damages. For Mr. Zenobia's case, the jury added $235,000 in punitive damages against Owens, Illinois. Now, what's really key here is understanding the legal reasoning the jury used to justify these punitive damages at the trial level.
Right. The initial punitive award wasn't based on, intentional harm, but rather on a finding of what's termed implied malice. In the context of the trial, this meant the jury concluded that Owens, Illinois had acted with gross negligence, demonstrating a reckless disregard for human life and safety regarding the well-documented dangers of asbestos.
Okay, so a significant amount of money intended to punish Owens, Illinois for their conduct. But as we know, that wasn't the final word, was it? Owens, Illinois wasn't exactly celebrating this outcome.
Naturally, they weren't. Owens, Illinois decided to appeal the punitive damages award, arguing that the legal foundation for it was incorrect. Their main point was that simply being grossly negligent, even demonstrably so, shouldn't be enough to warrant punitive damages. They believed a higher standard needed to be met.
Which brings us to the central legal puzzle of the case. What exactly is the legal line in the sand for awarding punitive damages in Maryland? Is it enough to show a company was incredibly careless? We're talking gross negligence here. Or does the person suing have to prove something even more serious?
That's the heart of the matter. The Maryland Court of Appeals took on this very question. Is implied malice, this idea of really bad negligence showing a reckless disregard, sufficient grounds for punitive damages? Or does Maryland law require proof of something much more deliberate and culpable, known as actual malice?
And the court's answer was pretty clear and, well, not what the plaintiffs were hoping for when it came to those punitive damages.
No, it wasn't. In a really significant ruling, the Maryland Court of Appeals stated definitively that for non-intentional tort cases and product liability is considered non-intentional in this context, punitive damages absolutely demand proof of actual malice. And crucially, they also specified that this actual malice must be proven by what's called clear and convincing evidence, which is, a higher bar than the usual, more likely than not, standard in civil cases.
Okay, let's really unpack this actual malice concept. What exactly did the court mean by that? It definitely sounds like it goes beyond just being really, really negligent.
You've hit the nail on the head. The court provided a very specific definition of actual malice. They said it requires conduct that is motivated by an evil intent, a genuine desire to injure someone, feelings of ill will, or outright fraud. So it's all about a defendant's state of mind, a deliberate and conscious decision to engage in wrongdoing.
So let me make sure I'm understanding this. Even if a company was shockingly negligent, maybe knew their product was dangerous, and people suffered harm as a direct result, that alone might not be enough to get punitive damages under this new rule.
That's the key insight from Zenobia. The court explicitly stated that even if the negligence is extreme, even if it seems outrageous, it doesn't reach the threshold for punitive damages in Maryland. This was a major shift in the legal landscape.
Wow.
And the court even explicitly overturned some previous rulings, including distinctions that had been made for cases that somehow arose out of contract and the precedent set in the Smith v. Gray Concrete Pipe Co. case.
Wow, that's a pretty big legal earthquake. And you mentioned this tougher standard of proof, clear and convincing evidence. Why did the court feel that was so important specifically when we're talking about punitive damages?
Well, the court's reasoning was that punitive damages serve essentially as a punishment, much like, you know, criminal penalties. They're not just about compensating the person who was harmed. They're intended to penalize the defendant and deter similar misconduct in the future.
Right, deterrence.
Exactly. Because of this punitive nature and the potential for significant financial consequences for the defendant, the court felt a higher level of certainty was required. They wanted to ensure that these penalties were only imposed when there was very strong and unambiguous evidence of malicious wrongdoing. As the majority opinion clearly stated, punitive damages require evil motive, intent to injure, or fraud. This higher standard acts as an important safeguard.
That makes sense. So when we apply this to a product liability case like Zenobia, what specifically would the plaintiffs have had to demonstrate to meet this new actual malice standard against Owens, Illinois?
In the context of product liability, the court laid out very specific hurdles for proving actual malice. First, the plaintiff would have to prove that the defendant, Owens, Illinois, in this case, had actual, not just suspected, knowledge of the defect in their asbestos products.
Actual knowledge.
Right. This isn't about what they should have known or what a reasonably prudent company would have known. It's about proving they actually possess that specific knowledge.
Okay. And what's the second critical element they'd have to prove?
The second crucial element is that the plaintiff must demonstrate that the defendant consciously and deliberately disregarded the foreseeable harm that would result from that defect. So it's not enough that they knew about the danger. They had to have made a conscious decision to ignore that danger, essentially putting people at risk despite that knowledge.
Conscious disregard.
Got it. As the majority opinion stated quite clearly on this point, the plaintiff must show that the defendant actually knew of the defect and of the danger of the product at the time the product left the defendant's possession or control. This really emphasizes that just, you know, a failure to investigate or a lack of due diligence isn't going to be enough to trigger punitive damages under this new standard.
Now, the Zenobia case also touched upon this important idea of a duty to warn, even after a product has been sold or a company stops making it. How did that fit into the court's decision?
That's a really interesting piece of the puzzle. The court acknowledged that in certain circumstances, a manufacturer might indeed have an ongoing responsibility, even after a product is out in the market, to warn consumers about newly discovered risks associated with that product. This is particularly relevant when the potential harm is severe and foreseeable, as it obviously was with asbestos exposure.
So even though Owens, Illinois stopped manufacturing asbestos products way back in 1958, the court still considered the possibility that they might have had a continuing obligation to warn people about the dangers of the asbestos products they had already sold.
Exactly. The court recognized that such a duty could exist. However, in the specific context of the Zenobia appeal, the primary focus really became the incorrect standard used for awarding punitive damages. While the duty to warn was a part of the original case and the jury instructions, the appeal largely hinged on whether implied malice was sufficient for punitive damages.
Oh, okay.
So the court's strong stance on requiring actual malice kind of overshadowed a deeper exploration of the specifics of the duty to warn in this particular appeal.
It sounds like a pretty clear decision from the majority of the court, but were there any other viewpoints or disagreements among the judges?
Yes, there were some significant nuances and dissenting opinions. Justice McAuliffe, while ultimately agreeing with the majority's conclusion, raised a cautionary note. He worried that a too strict interpretation of actual malice might inadvertently let some truly reckless behavior slide situations where a company shows like a shocking disregard for serious danger, even if they don't have a specific intent to cause harm in the way the majority defined it.
So he was essentially saying, let's be careful not to define this so narrowly that we miss conduct that is, you know, almost as bad as intentional harm.
Precisely. And then there was Justice Bell's dissenting opinion, which presented a more significant disagreement. Justice Bell agreed with getting rid of the old distinction for cases arising out of contract, and with raising the standard of proof to clear and convincing evidence for punitive damages.
Okay, so he agreed on those points.
Right. However, he strongly disagreed with the new requirement of actual malice. He argued that wanton or reckless disregard for human life should still be a valid and sufficient basis for awarding punitive damages.
And what was the core of Justice Bell's argument? Why did he think that extreme recklessness should still be enough?
Well, Justice Bell's main concern was that by requiring proof of evil motive or a direct intent to injure, the actual malice standard might allow companies to escape punitive consequences for conduct that is outrageously reckless, even if it doesn't meet the very specific definition of intentional harm.
Right.
He felt that some actions could be so incredibly reckless that they are practically equivalent to intentional wrongdoing in terms of how blameworthy they are and the need to deter such behavior. As he powerfully stated in his dissent, reckless disregard should suffice. It's as bad as intent. He was worried that the new standard tilted the legal scales too much in favor of defendants.
So when we look at the big picture, what was the long-term legal impact of Owens, Illinois v. Zenobia in Maryland? What's the crucial takeaway for, you know, anyone studying tort law today?
The Zenobia decision had a profound and lasting impact on how punitive damages are viewed and awarded in Maryland. It significantly raised the bar for plaintiffs in non-intentional tort cases, including product liability. Now, they need to present clear and convincing evidence of actual malicious intent rather than just demonstrating even extreme negligence or reckless behavior.
So for anyone diving into torts, this case is essential for understanding that critical difference in Maryland law between actual malice and implied malice, or gross negligence, especially when it comes to seeking punitive damages. It's a huge distinction.
Absolutely. It highlights the significantly higher burden of proof, that clear and convincing evidence standard that plaintiffs must now meet. And it also really underscores the ongoing tension in tort law as it tries to balance punishing intentional misconduct with deterring corporate behavior that, while not intentionally harmful, can still have devastating consequences. Zenobia firmly shifted Maryland's legal approach towards requiring that element of, well, intentionality for punitive awards.
This has been an incredibly insightful deep dive into Owens, Illinois v. Zenobia. It's so clear why this case remains a cornerstone in understanding tort law, especially concerning punitive damages and the complex responsibilities of manufacturers.
Indeed. It really makes you think about the different shades of wrongdoing and how the legal system attempts to address them through compensatory and, well, punitive damages.
So as you continue your legal studies, really consider this. How might this move towards the actual malice standard established in Zenobia have shaped the legal strategies and the ultimate outcomes in more recent cases involving product liability and toxic torts? Especially when we consider the ongoing societal discussions around corporate responsibility and accountability, is definitely a crucial point to keep in mind. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.